Hey guys, Bear Grylls here, just to say, super excited for Charles Thorpe's podcast coming soon. You guys are going to love this. What a great guy he is and so many great stories. So enjoy these and remember, above all, never give up.
Now, I personally believe that there's nothing better than a great adventure, whether it's to another country or into the backyard. It can have an amazing ability to change not just the way that we see the world, but also the way that we see ourselves. That is exactly what you're going to hear about from our incredible guests. On Great Adventures, I'm going to be hanging out with actors, athletes, thought leaders, and of course explorers, some old friends and some new, to discuss how being adventurous benefited their lives. My name is Charles Thorpe. For over a decade, I've been chasing down epic stories professionally for magazines and television shows, and now I'm bringing those conversations here. Joe Berlinger is the epitome of a storyteller, whether it's behind the camera or just sitting down with a coffee at Smile at the Freehand Hotel. As a documentarian, Joe has been everywhere in the world, from the Congo to on tour with Metallica. We discuss those journeys as well as his two Ted Bundy projects now available on Netflix, The Ted Bundy Tapes and Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile. Come check it out. You're one of those guys that has a lot of great stories. You've lived a lot of great adventures.
Totally, man. I mean, I feel very blessed to have had the career that I've had. You know, it's like an endless university where I get to be, I get to drop into these worlds, whether it's a week, a month, 3 years with Metallica, 20 years on the West Memphis case. The fact that I did both Conversations with the Killer, the doc series, and this movie at the same time is very bizarre. I don't think there's another, and I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying it's just so bizarre. I don't think...
It feels like a moment in history.
I don't think the same filmmaker has covered the same material in both scripted and unscripted simultaneously. And why I masochistically subjected myself to that, we can speculate upon. But, you know, in all seriousness, it's been a crazy 2 years doing both of these projects more or less at the same time. Emotionally draining because it's horrific. It's a horrific story.
Of course.
You know, I wish I could say there was some grand master plan, but sometimes the universe just kind of taps you on the shoulder and you're the guy. Mm. That's happened a few times in my career where... You know, there's certain projects that I think are going to happen and I push along, and the ones that, you know, sometimes happen just materialize and the door opens and you just have to step through.
The last time I saw you, you were in New York. You were coordinating going down to Kentucky to start, you know, production on this shoot, on this Ted Bundy movie. Yeah. And, you know, what was your mindset going into your narrative film? What do you feel like?
Well, I tell you, you know, it was people think because Zach was involved that somehow it was like a big Hollywood movie. This was about as indie as it gets. The budget was not high. Everyone took like 99% pay cuts to make the movie. We had 28 days to shoot the movie. You know, actually 2 weeks before we started shooting, there was some budgetary issues, and so we actually... I was told I had to lose some scenes, and the movie was cut from 33 days... These are 5 day weeks, so I had a week chopped out of my schedule. So we went from 33 to 28 days. We were shooting in Kentucky because that's who gave us or gave the producers the best tax credit.
Shout out to Kentucky. There we go. Thanks, Kentucky, for supporting film.
But the story has nothing to do with Kentucky, and we were in the dead of winter in Kentucky for a story that takes place in Utah, Colorado, Miami. And I'm forgetting a state. Oh, the Pacific Northwest. You know, because originally we were going to shoot the movie in Vancouver, which has a depth of crew and is the Pacific Northwest,
and a little more diverse. Yeah. You know,
I was a little. And Kentucky is trying to build out a film infrastructure, and where we were in Newport, Kentucky, is right across the river from Cincinnati, and Cincinnati is actually not a bad town. I actually enjoyed myself. But they don't have a depth of crew. So if one or two movies are already shooting there, unlike a place like Vancouver or New York, or Atlanta, you always find crews in big cities. But a place like Cincinnati or Newport, Kentucky, if there's a couple of movies going, you don't have crew. And so luckily, Gotti, the Travolta movie, had just wrapped, so there were some people available. But, you know, it was challenging. So, but despite all these challenges, literally I was working 7 days a week. We had a shortened prep period. We only had 5 weeks of prep instead of like a more typical 8 week prep period. I lost a week of shooting. It was cold, and we were in, you know, a geographic area that looks nothing like the story. So there were a lot of challenges, but despite that, on about day four or five, despite having just worked solid for 4 weeks and not having a weekend and working long days, I found myself, I was so elated and kind of like walking on air. And I noticed that within myself, and I was thinking, what is it? Why am I so happy? And it's precisely what you were kind of referring to before, my workload. And the reason I was so happy is there was a time in my career where I only did one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. When we made Brothers Keeper in 1990 and it came out in 92, all we did was Brothers Keeper. And then, in fact, Brothers Keeper went to Sundance and won the Audience Award, and people loved it, and it was kind of a pioneering film. I hate to say it.
It absolutely is. It's all out there. I mean, you're just repeating what people have already said on the internet.
But you know, despite it being a pioneering film now, back then people loved it, but thought it had no opportunity for distribution. Because there was no tradition of documentaries in the movie theater. Really, it was still very sporadic. Netflix was still, you know, some far off concept that nobody knew about. You know, back then, if you didn't sell your documentary to HBO or PBS, you weren't selling your documentary. Very different landscape. Digital didn't exist, streaming didn't exist. And so Brothers Keeper was passed on by all the distributors, even though it won a prize at Sundance. And so Bruce Sanofsky and I self-distributed that movie and schlepped it around from theater to theater, and it actually did quite well. It grossed like $2 million in an era of $5 movie tickets. Not that we kept all that money, believe me. Half of it stays with the theaters, and a bunch of theaters actually stiffed us. But, you know, we did okay.
Of course.
But the point I'm trying to make is that for 3 years, all we did was Brothers Keeper. And then HBO came knocking at our door, and that's how Paradise Lost started. And for 2 years, all we did was Paradise Lost. At a certain point, it becomes a business, and you're able to delegate, you're able to manage multiple productions. And at a certain point, my career for the last decade or so has been this massive juggle of three or four or five things going on simultaneously, which is doable in unscripted or in documentary, because no documentary, you know, shoots consecutive days for 3 months. You know, if you're doing a movie, you start prep. Prep mm-hmm. goes for 6 to 8 weeks, and then you have your shoot, which, you know, can be 2 months, 3 months, whatever. Then you edit your movie and you deliver your movie. You can only do a scripted movie one at a time. That's all you can do by definition.
Yeah.
But with documentary, especially, you know, if it's a cinema verite story where you're following stuff, that's, you know, you're weeks could go by before you shoot. So you tend to, if you can figure out and get a good system in place like I have at Radical, you tend to juggle multiple projects because nothing shoots consecutively. So my life for the last 10 or 15 years has been this massive juggle of three or four projects a year. And there are some benefits to that. Obviously, I'm raising a family in the early, you know, my daughters are now college age, but I had, you know, during that 10 or 15 years, I was raising a family, and making an income was important, and, you know, all that stuff. But I haven't done one thing at a time in a really long time. And so that feeling of elation I had on about day three or day four was like, oh, right, this is what it feels like to focus only on one thing. Because I had warned everybody in my life, obviously my family could reach out to me at any time, but I had warned everyone in my professional life, it better be really important, like an emergency, before you contact me, because I have this, I'm embarking on a new way of making movies, and I got to focus on this. And so people were great and left me alone. And so all those outside distractions and there's just something magical about the creative process where you're, you know, you peel away the layers and you are literally just kind of in the moment.
Yeah, present.
I haven't been in the moment on in a really long time where I'm not having multiple distractions.
Yeah.
So that was great, and I really enjoyed that. And that, I guess that's the thing I enjoyed the most about the whole process. was just focusing on one thing. Yeah. I know that sounds crazy, but for me it was very liberating.
And being there with this great cast and getting to focus with them and, and you know, going to this different state. Again, obviously, if you were shooting in New York City, it'd be a different situation. If you were shooting Los Angeles, it would be a different situation. But
I'm used to drop, you know, that's the one thing. I have, for better or worse, I have traveled the globe multiple times. Yeah. I have gone to some really far-flung locations. Thank God my wife, Lauren Eiferman, is a fantastic artist and loves... I mean, we love being together, but she doesn't mind being alone because she can spend all day in the studio and just do her thing. And, you know, we've been together since 1989, you know, so, you know, almost, well, together for 30 years, married for 28. And actually the secret to us being together is even though we've been married for 28 years, we've actually only been together for about three because I travel so much. I'm exaggerating slightly.
Of course, you are, absolutely.
I'm exaggerating slightly, but you know, I'm used to, you know, I've had some pretty far flung adventures.
Yeah,
that actually I'm getting tired of. I've done some grueling travel to some really remote places. I've shot in the Congo, I've shot in the jungles of Ecuador. You know, I've shot literally on every continent.
Yeah, and, give us one of those experiences. I mean, one of those that like change your perspective on life.
Well, it would have to be Crude. Years ago, a lawyer named Stephen Donziger, representing plaintiffs who were suing Chevron for the actions of Texaco in the Ecuadorian Amazon for oil pollution and bad drilling practices by Texaco, because Chevron bought Texaco in 2004. So the actions of Texaco were this lawsuit was trying to hold Chevron, you know,
liable
for the predecessor company's actions. This lawyer came to me and was pitching me the idea of doing a film about their case, and I was very dubious about it. You know. Spanish language, indigenous language. I just didn't feel, you know, I was concerned that this was a movie that a documentary that would be hard to raise money for. I was sympathetic, but I had never done a story outside of the United States. Usually I'm much more focused on U.S. issues, you know, criminal justice, whatever. Mm-hmm. But he kept after me and he said, look, let me take you down to the Amazon. Show you the pollution. And I said, look, I'll go down with you, but only if you understand that I'm dubious about doing this film. I think it's going to be hard to raise money. You know, a film about pollution in the jungle with Spanish-speaking Ecuadorians and Quechua-speaking indigenous people. I just, you know, this is actually before Netflix was doing production, for example. Today I probably could have funded it much easier, but in 2006 when I was being pitched the story, I just didn't see it as something that I could raise money for. And so, you know, and therefore, like, I just can't make a film for free. I did that once with Brothers Keeper. We gambled a dozen credit cards, second mortgages on homes, and went deeply into debt, and luckily it paid off. And I'm glad we did it, but I swore after that experience that I'm never going to make a film unless I can... I'll start a film on my own dime if I think I can fund it. But if I think it's hard to fund, I don't want to make the film. I did that once, and, you know, you risk a lot doing that. So I said, look, I'll go down and check it out, but you have to understand I'm dubious. So, you know, if I come back and say I'm not doing it, I don't want you to be disappointed. So he took me down to the Amazon, and we are paddling to an indigenous village. And as we pull up, you know, I see indigenous people sitting around a fire eating canned tuna, literally giant vats of tuna that you would buy at the cheapest bargain basement discount store. They were all eating canned tuna because the fish in the rivers were no longer abundant. There was terrible oil pollution. And, you know, I kind of took in the level of environmental degradation. I was resisting the idea of making this film. I still was processing my thoughts as I arrived home and I got to my you know, I have a decent house in a nice neighborhood.
Comfortable, yeah.
You know, so I live, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm one of those documentary filmmakers who is always struggling and doesn't have two nickels to rub together. That's just not who I am.
Right.
You know, I've
boy, figured, you had I, earned it at that point
in your
career. I
figured out how to do a business, make a business out of it. I also do commercials.
Right.
Haven't done commercials lately, but, you know, television commercials were a big part of the early part of my career. So, like, I always learned how to make a living. It's a business, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking people who put the filmmaking ahead of the business and who will risk everything to make a film. I did that a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not critical of that. But, you know, at a certain point, you have to raise a family, and that's my job. So, but I got to my, you know, decent house in Westchester, and I literally, you know, took a drink from my tap and looked at my clear water that I take for granted, knowing that these people have polluted drinking water. You know, not just any kind of person, indigenous people in the Amazon use the water for transportation, for bathing, yeah, for washing clothes, for cooking.
They can't go down to Costco and buy like a Poland Spring or anything
exactly
like that.
So, yeah. And then I went to go tuck my, you know, toddler, you know, in bed because I had been away, and I took a sip of water, and I was just thinking to myself, okay, the universe is, what kind of human being would I be to turn, you know, I am comfortable. And just because I don't know who's going to fund this film yet, you know what? For whatever reason, the universe is tapping me on the shoulder and saying, you have to do this. I just had this wave come over me that, you know what? You're being self... How can you leave that scene of poor... I don't want to say poor, impoverished.
Right.
Indigenous people being forced to eat canned tuna in the Amazon because of pollution... You know, you've got to make this film. So,
yeah.
And it was a struggle to make the film, and we eventually raised the money, and then it became this horrible situation. You know, there was a lawsuit. Chevron subpoenaed all my footage, and I decided to, you know, fight that subpoena, but I lost. It was a costly, ugly, and it's a whole long story. And honestly, you know, the people who I made the film about weren't upfront with me about some of the shortcuts that they were taking. You know, I think they believed that the ends justified the means, and some of the things they did in the legal proceedings were not appropriate. And Chevron pointed that out, and that undercut my ability to defend the footage. I mean, it's a whole ugly story.
It usually is when it involves the justice system
yeah,
like that.
It's a whole
you
ugly
know,
story,
yeah.
But I'm very proud of the film. Glad I made the film. But I forgot what your question was.
No,
prompted,
I'm glad you made the film.
I'm
glad you made the film too, because you know, like you mentioned, I think it was difficult to make a film like that at that time. Now we're seeing so much of it. There's a lot of environmental awareness, and I think people should go back and see it if they can.
Ironically, thinking about the Netflix connection, it was the last. You know, Netflix before it started really aggressively getting into original production. They experimented with equity investments in films with this thing called Red Envelope Entertainment. You know, obviously the Red Envelope is from the original days
the DVDs
of DVDs.
And
so Crude was the last film that Red Envelope Entertainment invested in before it decided to not just make equity investments, you know, in films, but rather to do wholly original productions.
Yeah.
And so there is some Netflix connection.
Some nice little synchronicity there. I mean, and obviously Netflix is doing some amazing work with the environmental programming too. So yeah, maybe you'll get back into that. That seems like a crazy trip. I'd like to welcome a new partner to this endeavor, Hiatus Tequila. Hiatus means to pause or break a sequence, which I believe is a great message. I'd always been a bourbon or whiskey guy until recently I started dabbling with tequila, especially in the summer. I met the founder of Hiatus, who is a fascinating guy and has done his due diligence in Mexico. Check them out on Instagram at Hiatus Tequila. I also want to get into a few other things, you know, people might know about is the Metallica documentary, and that was a crazy adventure too.
Oh my God, that was the adventure of a lifetime. You know, I think we have to tell the Blair Witch 2 story before
right.
the Do you know this story?
A little bit, yeah. I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear it right now.
Well, you know, the last time I did a movie 20 years ago was Blair Witch 2, and that was, you know, that's considered, you know, a fiasco by many people. But at the time, it was kind of a well-known story that I disavowed the movie upon release myself because I thought I had created a really cool, edgy movie that made fun of the whole idea of doing a sequel.
Right.
And at the 12th hour, literally, I was sitting with the mixing a movie that I thought was pretty good. Doing the score with Carter Burwell, who did the score, fantastic composer. And I get this phone call that they want, you know, it's August, mid-August, of the final stages of finishing a movie that is supposed to be released on 3,000 screens in six countries like 6 weeks later at the end of October, like two months later. With the marketing executive telling me, oh, well, we've changed our mind about the film we need to do this, that, and the other thing. And they made all sorts of changes that turned the movie into a traditional horror flick that just didn't work. And the movie, you know, got terrible reviews. You know, and the only thing worse than a movie getting, you know, slaughtered is knowing that you agree that a lot of the things that are in the movie weren't your responsibility. But, you know, there's actually, I mean, I'll recommend people listening to it, but if they do want to hear the story, there's on the director's commentary of the DVD of Blair Witch 2, somehow I convinced the studio that massacred the movie. I said, look, the only way I'm going to do a DVD commentary is if you let me talk about what my director's cut should have been and what you guys did to the movie. Ooh. And somehow the executive said yes. And so the DVD commentary of Blair Witch 2 back in 2004 had kind of a cult following because it was a refreshingly honest dissection of a disaster.
Yeah, there we go. Well, if you have iTunes, then get that right now.
But I took the disaster quite seriously at the time. You know, I wasn't quite 40, but you know, you see 40 on the horizon. And my kids were quite young at the time. So this is 20 years ago. So my one daughter had just been born. And, you know, I kind of like lost my way. And I was literally and figuratively kind of curled up in a ball of depression sitting at home. You know, because it did not, because I, you know, really the fact that I had lost control of the film and it was recut against my will, that was the painful part.
Yeah, it's jarring.
You know, I just took it all way too seriously because the first two outings, Brothers Keeper and Paradise Lost, weren't just liked, they were revered.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the reviews were fantastic. So if you believe your reviews on the way up and you allow the reviews to validate yourself artistically, then when the reviews are terrible, of course, you must invalidate yourself by your reviews.
Interesting.
And so that was the lesson I've tried to learn. I'm not always good at it, but that you can't validate yourself artistically by what other people say. Mm. Obviously, if you get repeatedly bad reviews, at a certain point it becomes a business problem, perhaps. Although reviewers, I think, are less relevant today, you know, with social media and all that.
It's continuing down that way.
People make up their own minds these days, much more so back then.
Right.
Where a review, you know, reviews could kill a film or not.
Although, now it's all aggregated.
Although Blair Witch 2, you know, was touted as, you know, a failure, but it was a $10 million film that grossed $54 million worldwide and did $25 million on DVD. So even the bad version of the movie was still Artisan's second highest grossing film. It just didn't do the unsustainable and unrealistic success of the first movie.
I
think I underestimated the venom that people had for the whole idea of doing a sequel. That was part of it, because look, they tried to forget about my movie and come out with another Blair Witch 2 recently that did even worse.
Yeah, that did not do well,
you know, financially or critically.
Yeah.
So it just was not in the cards to continue the Blair Witch franchise, and I underestimated the venom that people had towards it. But in any event, you know, I tried. I think there's aspects of the film that are really good. The original idea of the film was to warn people about the dangers of blurring the line between fiction and reality, because my observation about the original Blair Witch 1, and this is what the sequel was about a bunch of fans of the original movie,
recreating.
As we remember, or as hopefully, you know, some may recall, the original Blair Witch 2 was, people were tricked into going into the theater, people were claiming it was a real documentary, and that was what the marketing was about. It's a real documentary. And so I found the original movie almost offensive, because shaking the camera around somehow has become equated with reality, when real documentarians work really hard to make beautifully crafted, well-shot, well-edited films. And why shaking a camera aggressively means it's real,
right,
is a strange cultural shorthand. And more importantly, you know, Heather, Mike, and Josh, the stars of Blair Witch 1, were put on the cover of Time, Newsweek, and this marketing hoax was celebrated.
Right.
But nobody, you know, nobody took a step back and say, gee, if we trick people into going into a theater saying it's a real documentary and we start blurring the line between fiction and reality, pretty soon the truth won't matter.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original underpinning of that movie, which that idea got very muddled when the studio recut the film and tried to turn it into a traditional horror film. And shame on me for being overly intellectual and trying to serve up something intellectual and having some social commentary when the fans really just wanted a continuation of the found footage,
of course,
conceit. Yeah. Which to me is like, how can you continue the found footage conceit when they were on the cover of Time, Newsweek, and we all know
the jig's up.
The jig's up. But whatever, that's what the fans wanted, and God bless them. I underestimated what you know, that aspect of it, and clearly a lot of, you know, I'm not disavowing total responsibility for people rejecting that film. Although a new generation who's not, I have to say, even the bad version of the film that came out, there's a new generation that find it interesting, and
of course
they're not weighed down by the baggage of that first
film. It's a beautiful time we live in where people can rediscover like that.
Exactly. But the point of the story is it all went very badly.
Right.
After going great, you know, on set, no executives were around minding us, because there was an IPO for Artisan that's all they cared about, was selling the company, because that was the IPO craze back in 1999 into 2000. They were looking to just sell stock. And nobody was paying attention to the movie. We left the set thinking we had a great film, and then at the 12th hour it got recut into something that I was horrified over. That was the horror film,
right? She just pointed the camera at yourself as you right.
Exactly. So I, you know, so the movie came out, it got panned, and I was kind of in a ball, depressed, thinking, oh my god, what am I going to do now? And my wife, bless her heart, came into my office and handed me a copy of Paradise Lost and said, here, remind yourself that you're a good filmmaker. And you know, get off your feet and get back to work.
Yeah.
And so I popped on Paradise Lost, which I hadn't seen in years, and I'm looking at the opening title sequence, which is the Metallica track over the murder site, and all of a sudden the light bulb went off. Oh yeah, Lars and I, before I went off to do Blair Witch, Lars said he may want to, you know, do a film, because they were going back into the studio, and you know, we kind of casually talked about doing the Metallica film. So I kind of picked myself up and said, yeah, yes, I can do this. And I called Lars, and he invited me to come out to California. Now, Bruce Sinofsky and I had actually broken up at this point.
Right, you guys weren't working together
anymore.
We
weren't working together. The Blair Witch 2 thing was, you know, he was upset that I went off to do that. And, you know, creative partnerships are difficult after the second or third success, and we just needed a break from each other. And I went out to California thinking I was doing just some gig.
Yeah,
a little documenting of these guys going into the studio to slap on the back of a physical CD, because at that time they were still trying to sell physical CDs. You know, digital was just starting to come in, and they knew they had to make physical CDs even, you know, more fancy by adding some bonus footage. That's
of course.
Basically, I was shooting bonus footage in my mind, but I was just getting back on my feet after a bad result.
Listen to some good music.
And so I land, and I call Lars, and he says, oh, I forgot to tell you, Jason just quit the band. We may not be doing this record. Things are kind of falling apart. Our management hired some shrink. And I'm like, oh. And so I kind of push my way into that room.
Bravo.
And alone, not with Bruce. And I'm filming this first therapy session. And here are the icons of male testosterone, these, you know, amazing guys, you know, who are, you know, the metal image,
the most hardcore,
the most hardcore alpha image within a very image conscious business, are, you know, airing their feelings with one another and obviously going through this creative and existential crisis just like I was.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting there again. It's like the universe kind of put me there, in my opinion. I didn't realize it then, but, you know, just how much that has played into my career. But I was, I remember thinking to myself, I don't know why I'm here or how I got here, but I need to hear this stuff.
Yeah.
And in fact, I found it so inspiring and I found it so helpful that I realized, you know, I kind of broke up with Bruce in an ugly way. I have my reasons and, you know, it wasn't done intentionally, but I kind of left him aside in a way that probably wasn't great. And so I said, Bruce, you've got to come out and join me and make this film with me. So we made this film together. And we used these therapy sessions to heal our own relationship.
Yeah.
You know, after shooting, we would go back to the hotel room and talk about why our relationship hadn't worked. And, you know, it's a long story, but we ended up getting back on a good footing. And, you know, so
you get an amazing documentary out of it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't, you know, if I could go back in time and make Blair Witch 2 a massive success so that I would go off and go do another feature film and never have done the Metallica film, I would never choose that path.
I love it.
The making of the Metallica film and then continuing to focus on the Paradise Lost series that resulted in, you know, getting a guy off a death row and two guys off a life without parole sentences and Crude and Tony Robbins and all the things. I wouldn't trade, you know, it's good to have your face rubbed in mud every once in a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, not too often, but every once in a while.
Yeah. And I love just the message of seeing whatever path you're on and following that path wherever it leads you. And I think that's a beautiful, note to end on. Thanks
so
much for being here, Joe.
Cool. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, guys. If you like what you heard, hit subscribe and leave a quick review on iTunes. Suggest it to a friend who could use a little travel inspiration. If you have a travel question or suggestion on someone I should chat with, just hit me up on my social channels at Charles Thorpe and at Adventure Podcast. New episodes will be dropping every Friday, so keep checking in for the next. Until then, safe travels. Conversations were recorded at Smile Radio, located in Smile to Go at the Freehand Hotel.